This is KFSK's Midday Magazine for Friday, December the 14th. I'm Angela Denning. Deer hunters around Petersburg could see a longer season under a pair of proposals before the state's Board of Game next month. At a meeting earlier this month, Petersburg's Fish and Game Advisory Committee voted to support longer hunting seasons, but wasn't unanimous on the change. Joe Vicknicki reports.
Petersburg resident Steve Burrell submitted the two proposals to extend the local deer hunting seasons from the current closure date of October 31st until November 15th, adding 16 days and making it a month-long season. The proposals cover seasons on Mitkoff, Wawodski, and Butterworth Islands, along with the Lindenberg Peninsula of Kuprinoff Island. Tom Schumacher is a regional supervisor for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Division of Wildlife. He listened in to a meeting in Petersburg by phone and told the committee that the change might double deer harvest during the local seasons, but he explained deer numbers show some signs of increasing.
Your estimates, we don't have much for Mitkoff, but for Kuprinoff, Seattle, Lindenberg, at least our alpine counts have been going up. We don't really know yet how alpine counts relate to the numbers of deer in the woods, but harvest has also gone up quite a bit, so we think
Schumacher said the department is neutral on the proposals, but thought there was some room to lengthen the season. Department comments note that doubling the harvest may not be sustainable. Hunters on Mitkoff, Wawodski, and Butterworth Islands have averaged 71 bucks a year the last 3 years, and 46 a year on Lindenberg. Committee member Frank Neidefer wondered about conservation concerns in the area.
Well, I'd kind of oppose it because we've had meetings here where we're trying to, you know, taking too many deer. Remember, just by the proxy hunts and such, they were complaining about too big of harvest, and this is just going to increase the harvest quite a bit.
The season and bag limit on Mitkoff and Lindenberg Peninsula are among the most restricted in the state because of population concerns. Hunters have 15 days and can only take one buck. The state board shortened the Lindenberg season in 2013 over concerns about deer numbers. Committee member Stan Malcolm also sounded opposed.
Doubling the season length is a big move. I would have a little concern doubling the season length.
And the time frame.
But others on the committee thought a longer season is a good idea. Here's David Bennett.
I know the guys that have been doing the aerial deer counts the last several years. It's pretty extensive survey they've been doing, and the deer numbers on Lindenberg Peninsula have been going up steadily. There's deer there now to harvest. You know, I think we should extend the season and harvest those deer while they're here.
Lengthening the season would also provide hunting opportunity when deer are in the rut or during mating, when typically hunters have more success. Don Spiegelmeyer raised that point.
I sure would like to get a crack at that first week in November. I know that's
when they show up.
That's that peak of that rut. You know, me being a primary archer, I mean, that's for me, that's a time of year that you know, I might get a chance to get and score with my bow. So
the vote was 8 in support, 4 against, and 1 abstention. The input from advisory committees around the region, public comments, and staff reports will help the state board decide the proposals in mid-January. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
There is opportunity for public comment during the state board meeting. The board is also accepting public comment on proposals until December 28th. You can find a link to the state website along with this story on kfsk.org. Petersburg School Board approved a new 3-year contract for Superintendent Erica Kluepainter. The unanimous vote of support came at the board's last regular meeting. Before becoming superintendent, Erica Kluepainter had been the principal at the Ray C. Stedman Elementary School for about 13 years. Leading the school district wasn't a job she was really looking for. In 2014, she stepped into the role as interim superintendent when a new hire didn't stay long. At first, Kluepainter says, the transition was hard.
I was really happy in my job at the elementary school. I loved being a principal. I miss a lot of things about that. You know, on a daily basis, I miss certain things about seeing regular contact with kids and all those kinds of things. I miss certain things about working, you know, just daily with staff.
But she's since grown into the job. She says she's learned a lot from others around the state about policy and programs. And she's found things that she does enjoy about being superintendent.
I'm highly, highly connected with this community and the district. So from that perspective, I've always said I could learn about the job because I'm really connected to this community. I'm very committed to the community. I care a lot about it, and I care a lot about what happens in our schools and our kids. So I figured I could learn things about the job, and I think I have.
School board president Mara Luchomsky spoke on the board's behalf, saying that they appreciate that Clue Painter stepped up in the first place and that she has continued to remain in her leadership role.
As a board, we are very thankful that we have her in place where she is. We're happy for all of the learning that she does do and the leadership that she gives to our district and, you know, the direction that she takes us in.
Luchomsky says Clute Painter goes above and beyond her role as superintendent, wearing many different hats. And she takes on those roles without complaint.
We're a small district, and we're a conservative district, and we don't just hire in somebody to do the extra work that needs to get done, whereas many other districts would. And we have staff to thank for that, and especially Erica for just saying, okay, I'll do that, and I'll do that. Oh, and I'll do that too. So we're thankful for her, and we're very confident in signing this contract.
Clue Painter's three-year contract runs 2019 through 2022. Her salary will be $130,000 the first year and bump up to $135,000 the next 2 years. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning. A Craig man was sentenced this week in federal court to 10 years for his role in distributing methamphetamine on Prince of Wales Island. An announcement from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Alaska states that 63-year-old Bradley Peyton Grasser pleaded guilty to meth conspiracy for actions that started at least as early as 2014. The announcement says that Grasser coordinated and directed the distribution of meth in various communities on POW. It states that he arranged for the drugs to be mailed from Washington to at least 5 co-conspirators on the Big Island and in Ketchikan, and that he collected drug sale proceeds and then used those proceeds to continue the operation. According to the announcement, investigators seized a total of 1,133 grams of meth. Law enforcement also seized about $90,000 in drug proceeds, along with other property. Agencies cooperating on the case include the Alaska State Troopers, the U.S. Postal Inspection Service, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and the Craig and Klawock Police. Just about a month after halibut and black cod fishing came to a close, fishermen are taking stock of their seasons. Some longliners using a new piece of gear, known as longline pots, to prevent whales from stealing their catch, are returning happier than some others. Aaron Bolton reports from Homer.
Yeah, right there's one right underneath you, killer whale.
Oh, you dirty.
Bill Harrington is not happy. A pod of killer whales is swarming his boat as he returns to pull in his line. The sound is a dinner bell for both the pod and a large sperm whale that surfaces about 20 feet from his boat.
Whoa, mother.
This video was shot 10 years ago when Harrington longlined in the eastern Gulf of Alaska. Harrington and his crew would travel 100 miles or more and bait thousands of hooks attached to a commercial fishing line by hand before anchoring it to the ocean floor between two buoys. A sperm whale or just a couple of killer whales can pick a line clean as it's pulled in.
As far as I'm concerned, they're only thieves in tuxedos.
Harrington retired a few years back, and he says the problem only got worse. However, federal fishery managers say the number of black cod whales are eating off long lines has been decreasing over the past decade. Currently, the National Marine Fisheries Service estimates that whales eat about $3.1 million worth of black cod statewide per season, just a fraction of the overall catch. The International Pacific Halibut Commission doesn't currently estimate those numbers for halibut, but fishermen say they're losing thousands of dollars per trip. Roy Wilson lives in Cordova and delivered his last halibut load of the season to the docks in Homer in early November. His crew is washing off the deck after a trip to the Aleutian Islands, a trip Wilson ended early because of killer whales.
We just left a lot of fish on the grounds, probably $50,000 worth of fish on the grounds that we won't ever see again, but at least the fish are alive.
Despite smaller paychecks for both him and his crew, Wilson is happy killer whales didn't steal more of his catch. A potential solution to this problem is coming from new regulations. In the coming years, longline fishermen in western Alaska will be allowed to catch halibut in longline pots, something black cod fishermen in the region have done for years, and those in the Gulf of Alaska began in 2017. Instead of fish being exposed on hooks along the ocean floor, fish swim into enclosed containers, seeking the bait inside. The pots protect the catch from sperm and killer whales looking for an easy meal. Wilson also fishes for black cod and made the switch to pots.
If everybody could go to pots, it would be a great thing for the fishery.
However, only 12% of black cod pulled from the water by longliners this season were caught in pots. And there are reasons some fishermen are reluctant to make the switch. Pots take up more space on the fishing grounds, and they can get tangled with traditional longline gear. That's why the North Pacific Fishery Management Council prohibited pots in the 80s and 90s. But now that regulators have reapproved the gear, there's another barrier.
The gear is just so expensive.
Homer longliner Eric Velsko is thinking about spending $200,000 just to get started. Like Wilson, Velsko also views the switch as a conservation measure, as he fears black cod managers are underestimating just how many fish whales are eating.
You know, I think if we just keep doing what we're doing, it's just going to get worse and worse and harder every year.
Velsko may stop black cod fishing altogether and focus on other fisheries if he can't afford the switch to pots. Back on the deck of Wilson's boat, his 28-year-old daughter Marissa Wilson is cleaning fish. She worked for her dad full-time up until last year when she took a desk job in conservation.
This is the first year that I haven't gone out fishing, and it's been, I've had to do a lot of soul-searching.
She's been thinking about buying her own boat, but deciding what fishery she might invest in first is a big financial decision.
I don't think I'll ever stop feeling like a fisherman. I'm taking a little hiatus, but I've always got my eyes on the ocean.
Wilson says she's leaning towards fishing for black cod in the Bering Sea. And if she invests in pots, she won't have to worry about those thieves in tuxedos. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Police officers swarmed into the Petersburg Medical Center at 2 o'clock Wednesday afternoon. As some staff left the building, it was all part of a training session on how the hospital would respond to a shooter at the facility. Staffers assembled nearby at a rally point and reviewed what worked and what didn't, while police went through the medical center and tested other staff barricaded in place. Joe Vicknicki caught up with Petersburg Volunteer Fire Department spokesman Dave Berg, along with the medical center's Phil Hofstetter, Jennifer Briner, and Angela Menish at the John Hansen Senior Hall.
We received a call of an active shooter at the hospital, and EMS was requested to set up a station here at the A&B Hall. This has been a safe haven for hospital employees and anyone in the public that is needs information about the incident. And so we will respond and assign EMS personnel as they're ready to go from this location.
How is the drill going so far? I'll start with Phil.
We don't know. We don't really have much information. We heard some shots down in the admin office, and then folks evacuated, and here we are in the rally point, and right now we're getting a head count. And one of the things we're realizing, we just don't have communication with the folks in charge, which would be law enforcement. So we just don't know what's going on.
This is a head count. You said this is clearly not the entire staff.
No, yeah. So the two things that staffers to do, either evacuate if they can or you know, barricade or stay in place. Those are the two options. So once they're here at the rally point, then they try to log in, get a head count. But we don't have much information beyond that, so. Yeah.
And clearly not evacuating the long-term care folks or anything like that? So Jennifer?
For this drill, long-term care and the acute care patients were not in place, so they would not have been evacuated. In case of real life, if we could get somebody out easily, we would get them out with us. But we need to just do whatever we can to get as many people out of the building as possible.
Angela, it looks like people are taking this well as could be? How do you think the drill is going?
Well, I think as far as emotions go, people, we did, you know, prepare people for it. So I think people had some idea of what to expect, and there's been some trainings to help prepare people. So I think that's a positive. But I still think even though it's a drill, people still, there's still adrenaline going.
And we're the people that got out.
Yeah.
So we're not in the middle of that. We walked, when we came out, there the SWAT team people were coming in, and that's all we saw of the drill.
You heard gunshots.
Yeah.
And then they, as far as the evacuation, they walked down. How did that go in your areas? Did you feel like you knew what to do? Was there
anything? I forgot. I had a radio.
Wednesday's drill at the medical center involved several law enforcement agencies, school officials, and other volunteers. Well, it's Friday, December the 14th, and it means it's time for our stocks report with Dan Berg. He's a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Bellevue, Washington, and he's joining us by telephone. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Angela.
What's the news this week?
Well, the week started out well, but ended poorly, and it's been the what you've heard on the news quite a bit lately. There's worries of slowing growth, not just in the U.S., but in a variety of economies. And the whole thing is exacerbated by the very uncertain trade policy that we find ourselves in. So that was shown once again to in this week's results. Overall, the week's results weren't too bad, but the trend is down for now. So let's start with a few bits of economic news about the U.S., the Consumer Price Index, which folks who receive Social Security should be paying good attention to, that number for November was up 0.2%, and year-on-year 2.2%, which is right on target for the Fed. And so the Fed is looking for no acceleration in inflation, and they got what they wanted. And we also were just thinking about the jobs report, which was on last Friday. That was a little weaker than expected and fits in with the scenario of a little bit slower growth. And one thing that some of the listeners may be wondering about is the government shutdown. And some of the things I've read about it is that 75% of government functions are already funded. And so what would be shut down is fairly limited. And so the market is not really reacting to that at the moment. Over in the EU, the EU had some fairly weak economic numbers also. It showed that some of the industrial production in France actually contracted last month, which is not good. And the European Central Bank is cutting its growth forecast for next year. But on a little bit better note, though, Prime Minister May survived her confidence vote, and so the possibility of avoiding a hard exit of the UK out of the EU is still there, although it's that also is somewhat uncertain. Some of the commentators I've been reading about that feel that that is really not that material for the U.S. economy, but it would certainly be negative for the EU and possibly cause a recession in the United Kingdom. Over in China, which is in the news a lot these days, today there was more evidence of their economy slowing. Their industrial production numbers were weaker than before. Also, they had weaker retail sales numbers. And there's a fair amount of anecdotal evidence that's been accumulating over there that, you know, if the trade thing is uncertain and we have like a 3 month extension, a lot of folks who are sourcing product from there are reconsidering their sourcing decisions or putting off purchases, and so that's beginning to hurt the Chinese economy. It's hard to put numbers on exactly what that is, but those reports are definitely increasing. However, they did give a couple of olive branches to the Trump administration this week. They are buying some of our soybeans in a goodwill gesture, and one of their retaliatory tariff actions was rolled back, so they're not going to increase tariffs on American cars by 25%, but they'll keep them at the standard rate of 15% for now. So for the week, the Dow Jones closed at 24,100. That's off 288, or about 1.1% for the week. Certainly felt worse than that, though. The NASDAQ did a little bit better. That closed at 6,910. That was about an 0.8% drop. And the S&P closed at 2,599, about a 1.2% drop for the week. So most of that drop happened today. Oil has remained fairly weak in spite of the recent OPEC agreement. However, it may be that there's a floor on oil prices now. That's what some folks are saying. So the West Texas barrel was at $51.22. That was down a little bit more than $1.40 for the week. Hopefully for Alaska and for North Dakotans, that's going to stop going down. Gold was off a little bit this week to $1,237. Now, the bond market really didn't have much change this week. The 30-year Treasury is at 3.14%, and the 10-year is at 2.89%. But I'd like to put that in the context of the other stuff we've been talking about, which is somewhat slower expectations for the economy. Over the last 30 days, the 10-year Treasury, which is the benchmark for mortgage rates in this country, has gone from 3.18 to 2.89, a two-tenths of a point drop. And that's a bit of a vote of the bond market, they say, is smarter than the stock market, and the bond market is telling us that growth is, in fact, slowing.
Okay. Well, thanks for that information, Dan. And what about individual stocks this week?
Well, Costco, which I'm sure a lot of us own, symbol COST, had a very bad day today. It was down 7%, closed at $207.02. They had a fairly good earnings report, but their sales growth was a little bit disappointing, and traffic was a little bit disappointing also. So Costco is definitely growing, but for a relatively expensive stock, it wasn't enough to keep the stock value up there. Same thing for Adobe, symbol ADBE. They had an absolutely fabulous earnings report, but the stock slipped a little bit today to $230.30. Another stock in the penalty box is one of the standard blue chips in the Dow, Johnson & Johnson. That closed down sharply today to 133. It takes a lot of sellers to bring a stock this big down 10% in a day. And the news on Johnson & Johnson was that they really have known about asbestos in baby powder for years. Think about that for a moment, Angela. A company that really has sold all of these products to us, especially for our children, knew about that. So if that is true, if that's a true report and they're disputing that, they've got a lot of litigation ahead of them. Starbucks had an investor day, symbol SBUX, that closed at 65.34. They lowered their earnings per share growth outlook to 10% from 12%. That trimmed the stock a bit. Bank of America, BAC, closed at 24.48. And the reason why I bring that up is that most of the big financials right now are hitting 52-week lows. And Bank of America was nicely above $31 a share just not that long ago. And finally, Alaska Airlines, ALK, closed at $62.30. That was up today on weak oil prices.
Okay. And then what's coming up next week? That's almost leading us to the holidays.
Well, there's no holiday for stock investors, I'm sorry to say. It's going to be an active week. By far, the biggest thing next week is going to be the Federal Reserve meeting, where they decide whether or not they're going to raise interest rates, the short-term ones that are overnight. And it looks as though the market is saying, yes, they'll do that. But what people really want to know is, what are they going to be doing next year? And what the Fed was saying earlier this year is they might raise it as much as four times next year. Now they're not quite so sure, and the futures market is telling us that they might not even raise it more than once, if at all. And then for company news and earnings, we've got Oracle, FedEx, Conagra, Nike, and Micron out of Boise. Those are five big companies that are announcing next week.
Okay, well, thanks so much for joining us this week, Dan, and we will check in with you again next Friday.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too. Dan Berg is a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Bellevue, Washington.
Listeners are reminded that the information provided is general in nature and may not apply to their personal investment situation. Individuals should consult with their chosen financial professional before making any decisions. Investment products and services are offered through Wells Fargo Advisors, a trade name used by Wells Fargo Clearing Services, LLC, member SIPC. Neither Wells Fargo Advisors nor its financial professionals are legal or tax advisors.
This wraps up KFSK's Midday Magazine. I'm Angela Denning. Thanks for listening.